Alright, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Movie Commentary Podcast. It's the podcast in which we'd watch movies and talk about movies. And today, it's the first episode after our Halloween kind of month, so we're going to do a little something different. We're going to watch a movie from 1964, starring the Fab Four, also known as Paul McCartney, John Lennon, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr. I am, of course, referring to the legendary film A Hard Day's Night, which is also the namesake of their, I believe it was their third studio album that was released in the UK. And not a whole lot of other introduction. Again, I kind of want to do a bit of a shorter episode this week for various reasons, but also, again, I'm a big Beatles fan, and this is a movie that is kind of very near and dear to my heart. So, without further ado, let us go ahead and start the film. And the film starts off. You can hear it. You can kind of turn the movie down. But it's actually really funny because, and I literally just saw it here. So, the opening shot of the film here is a shot of the Beatles running away from their supposed fans. Apparently the people in these opening scenes are actually fans, and you can actually see it in that opening shot there. While they're running down the street, the sidewalk there, George Harrison completely wipes out, and apparently he also rips his suit. And one thing that I did notice about it is there was one of the lead people that was leading the fans chasing them. He actually had to put his hands up and say stop, 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 or else they were just gonna trample over them. So, and I just saw that in here, so that's pretty interesting. I think that scene, they originally were gonna try and get rid of it, but it was obviously kind of a funny scene. It's actually kind of an iconic opening to the film, so along with that amazing opening chord that George Harrison plays along with George Martin on the piano. Of course I don't play guitar. I have a little bit of music background, but I mean that opening chord to A Hard Day's Night, one of the most legendary chords, has actually been studied for, what the actual notes and what the actual fingers on the guitar and what chords they would play and what chords on the piano they would play and how they would make that. I mean, there have been people that have done like college dissertations over what notes or what chords were played in that opening chord to A Hard Day's Night. And again, it's such a legendary way to kickstart it. It just bang kind of to A Hard Day's Night, starts the film off and really starts off the album too. So, and here's Paul McCartney with his fake goatee on. So, I'm not gonna lie. This film was conceived. Well, they decided to make this film honestly before the Beatlemania truly started to kick in. This film is produced by United Artists, who there was kind of a loophole role, or some kind of rule that they could kind of exploit for a lot of money, in which they could actually produce a Beatles film and basically distribute the soundtrack to it. So United Artists, basically the reason this film exists is because United Artists wanted to cash in on some of the Beatles' success, and they didn't really even think the film itself was going to make a whole lot of money, but in fact it actually turned out to one of the most profitable films of all time. So we are now being introduced to Paul's grandfather, who's played by Wilfred, I believe, Bramble, who is a real actor. I think he's a British actor, I'm not terribly sure, but he had been in several films before this, and let me find that the guy downtown here. Anyway, it's also really funny because watching this again, because I watched this scene so many times, I can quote this, like, you know, hello, grandfather, hello. You can talk then, can he? Of course he could talk. He's a human being, didn't he? I also try to pride myself on the on my you know, Beatles accents that I can do. Yeah, Wilford Bramble. There we go. Irish actor from Ireland. Yeah, I'd probably say it's probably one of his, you know, most famous, you know, acting roles that he was in. Now we are also now being introduced to Shake, played by John Junkin, I believe, who was a British actor, and he's the fictional Beatles road manager. Now it's actually kind of interesting. The actual Beatles road manager, Shake here, he's kind of based on, I believe, probably he's kind of a mix between, I believe, Neil Aspinall and Mal Evans, kind of two guys that really were the you know, Beatles, you know, road manager, probably the Beatles, like, road manager. And also Shake, John Junkin apparently talked to Mal Evans, you know, the Beatles roadie, and basically the guy that would set up his, like, Mal Evans, the guy that would set up their equipment, you know, at shows and kind of drive them around and kind of also their bodyguard. Mal Evans did a lot of roles for the Beatles, but apparently John Junkin actually talked to Mal Evans, and he was trying to ask, like, hey, what do you do actually, so I can kind of get your, you know, get what you kind of get the role of the character and whatnot. And so, yeah, so the Shake character, John Junkin's character Shake, is kind of based on kind of a mix of Neil Aspinall and Mal Evans. So, oh, this is funny, just the funny scene. You get this old man that's kind of walking into the cart with the boys, and he's obviously one of the, like, really stuck up kind of guy. So, and nothing that I didn't know, say there, we were also introduced to the Beatles' other fictional manager named Norm, I do believe, played by Norman Rossington, who actually appeared on, and I do believe I may have, and I believe I may have mentioned this when I did this episode a few months ago, but Norman Rossington, who plays the Beatles' fictional manager, is actually Norman Rossington. He played a steward on the Titanic in the 1958 film, A Night to Remember. Again, I covered that film probably back in August when I first started this podcast. So I would say, again, this is probably one of Norman Rossington's favorite famous films. I don't know of any other films that he was in, but or a whole lot of other films that he was in, but this one and A Night to Remember, two films that I know a lot. So, you know, one of the things that's actually kind of, one of the things that's, that A Hard Day's Night kind of does for the legacy of the Beatles is it kind of cements their stereotypes, because, as you know, the Beatles themselves, all four of the Beatles, they kind of have, like, these, like, stereotypes of them. Like, you kind of know how, like, Paul McCartney is kind of a, you know, that Paul McCartney's kind of, like, the cheeky, cute one, and how John Lennon's a bit of a smart aleck kind of guy, kind of, you know, character, and then Ringo is kind of the kind of gloomy, slapsticky kind of character, and then George Harrison, I can't remember. Again, he's kind of the you know, the quiet one. So, and the thing is, I mean, this film is really, for a lot of people back in the 60s, was their first, you know, at least for a lot of people not in the UK and, you know, not in around Europe. I mean, this is a lot of their first introductions to the Beatles, as just people themselves, you know, I mean, and for even a lot more people, even in the UK, it was their first introduction to them as people, because, you know, again, you know, back in those days, you know, you didn't have, like, you know, the social media, you know, you wouldn't get to know these guys online or any of that kind of thing. So, So I'm pretty sure when people actually saw this film, they actually were thinking, like, man, this is actually how they are, and, you know, this is actually how they, you know, function. You know, this is how Paul McCartney is, and this is how George Harrison acts. This is how John Lennon acts, and, you know, Ringo Starr acts, so. The thing that I think really also, I think about this film is I think it actually does, I think it does capture their personalities quite well, actually, because the screenwriter for this film, a guy by the name of Alan Owen, he actually wrote the screenplay kind of after following the boys around for a while, and he kind of wrote the script based on, you know, things that he thought that the boys would say. Of course, I'm pretty sure the Beatles actually did a lot of ad-libbing. They know they did a lot of ad-libbing in this film based on all the things that they would say, so. I also feel, I love some of these scenes. John Lennon has some of the funniest lines in any movie. He's like, Have you seen Paul's grandfather? He's like, of course he's concealed about me person. It's like, and then, you know, George, and then Ringo starts like, I can tell his grandfather doesn't like me. I think this film also, yeah, and then so they're just on the train looking for Paul's grandfather now. It's actually really interesting because the Beatles themselves, they're not classically trained actors at all, and they're no actor experience at all. Sure, they hardly had any professional, you know, music experience at all. I mean, they're kind of self-trained musicians, but they come in here and, you know, they basically and essentially play themselves, I think, and of course, I also said that, you know, they're kind of fictional versions of themselves, a little bit overblown, but I think also, you know, looking at real-life interviews of them, it, you know, kind of matches, actually, so. But what was I going to say there? But you know, they're given, but even though, like, they're not classically trained actors, and their performances of themselves is, as at least comedic-wise, is just really funny and really good, actually. I mean, you know, I feel like you get a lot of these, like, you know, musicians that, like, get in front of cameras. I mean, it's just kind of, like, cringeworthy to watch it because they're just, oh, this is not good at all. But, I mean, I like watching these guys because, I mean, they just, you know. And one thing they even talk about a lot with, you know, real actors and actresses in films is, you know, is the chemistry between actors and actresses. And of course, I don't think no four group of, you know, human beings in the world, you know, in history have ever had the chemistry that, you know, those four guys have had together. And of course, they also do a real good job of, you know, kind of factoring in the, you know, the you know, obviously, you know, the Wilford Bramble, you know, Norman Rossington and John Junkins character, so. So now they're playing cards, and now it's going to start playing into I Should Have Known Better, which they're going to actually kind of mime it, actually. That's one of the things that they did a lot in this film is that they had the songs kind of in the background, and then when they filmed the scenes, they would actually have the Beatles, you know, kind of mime play the songs and all that kind of stuff. Even though, you know, John Lennon playing the harmonica there, and, you know, they're both, you know, they're all playing their songs. Of course, in the real version of I Should Have Known Better, John, I think, would have been playing his rhythm guitar, and it only shows him playing his, you know, harmonica here. And, of course, you know, Ringo's only playing the hi-hat and the snare, and not even the bass drum, so. You know, that's the one thing. You know, as we'll go into this movie, I mean, the shooting of the music scenes has actually been very influential in kind of the development of you know, the music video, you know, industry. And, you know, shoot, even the director of this film, Richard Lester, has been called the father of MTV for his, you know, basically for his, you know, work on this film and how he shot, like, the Beatles, like music scenes, and how it's, like, you know, such, how it was kind of groundbreaking at the time, so. Yeah. So yeah, now they're just playing the song, playing the, as John Lennon would call, the mouth organ. So, you know, it's actually kind of interesting here. There's in the coming up here. Yep, no, right here. So there's Patty Boyd in this scene. Now, Patty Boyd, have been a lot of Beatles fans know as the first wife of George Harrison. In fact, they met on this movie. And while filming, I believe, George Harrison actually asked her out to dinner. And at the time, Patty Boyd actually had a boyfriend, actually. And so she was like, I can't do it. And then George Harrison was like, shoot, I'm only asking out to dinner, you know, in his impression there. So they went out, and I think 18 months after the film was released, they actually, you know, got married, so. They also, so that Ringo's wearing all his, you know, famous rings. That's actually why Ringo is called Ringo, because he's got all those, like, rings that he's wearing on. He's always worn, like, all these rings kind of on his fingers that he's been, you know, when he's playing drums, so. The interesting thing about, you know, all these police officers trying to hold all these, you know, fans back and all this kind of stuff is, it's honestly isn't that far removed from reality, because, you know, the Beatles, I mean, shoot, when you know, by the time this film was released, I mean, Beatlemania was really in effect, especially in America, because this film was released a few months after their appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show, which really just exploded their exposure on in America. And, you know, after this, I mean, they were, you know, explaining it was, you know, just absolute chaos, you know, every time that, you know, they were around. I mean, there were so many people around trying to get a look at them. Of course, it's always really interesting kind of hearing their perspective from it, especially, you know, Paul and Ringo nowadays, is, you know, how they were essentially living in kind of like their own little bubble, per se, of, you know, how they were so just, you know, surrounded by, you know, just in this bubble of, you know, fame and all that kind of stuff, so. Yo, Window Ratlison, it's actually really funny because they're talking about Ringo Starr snoring. And they're talking about how he's, like, snoring and whatnot, and it's always funny because Ringo's always made fun of for having a gigantic nose, which he does. So it's actually really interesting because again they're at a hotel, they're in a hotel room right now, and there's always, I remember one of the stories that they would always tell about their real life instances that. You know, when they were on the road touring in the early 60s, the Beatles themselves, they were always, like, really grateful for these moments kind of in their, you know, hotel rooms, because it was really their moments to really kind of unwind and get away from the public spotlight, because, you know, you gotta imagine, I mean, back in the day, they were going to either playing shows, they were going to the studio recording, or they're making some kind of TV appearance or all that kind of stuff. So yeah. So yeah, now it's kind of funny. Norm's making them answer all this fan mail that they got, and they just came in with like two just giant piles of fan mail for all the Beatles to respond to. So again, I'm pretty sure relatable to what actually happened in real life, you know, what actually happened with the Beatles. So that's the thing. Like, I mean, for this film is like all fictional and is kind of, you know, off stage, but I do believe that in some kind of fashion, it actually kind of mirrors what they actually experienced on a day-to-day basis in real life. That's really interesting. There's a butler that just came into the room, into their hotel room, and that man was also in A Night to Remember as well with Norman Rossington. So again, that's really interesting. Okay, so they're at a club now dancing, and Ringo is just dancing his fool head off, and he is, you know, Ringo is also very famous for being a club dancer, and he was really famous for getting out and dancing a lot. So the song here is playing is I Want to Be Your Man, which was released in their second album, I think with the Beatles, sung by Ringo Starr, but it was actually given to the Rolling Stones and was actually the Rolling Stones' one of their first major hits, actually. Of course, a lot of people talk about the rivalry between they talk about the rivalry between the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. Of course, the Beatles gave a lot of the Rolling Stones a ton of songs and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's always really fun. Okay, so now here's another song that they're playing. Now, this is actually a really underrated song in the Beatles lore. This is Don't Bother Me by George Harrison. This is actually his first ever song that he wrote that appeared on a Beatles song. And Beatles songs that was released, actually. Of course, George Harrison actually later kind of disowned the song. Of course, I mean, he went on to write, had a very prolific and accomplished, you know, songwriting career after this. I mean, even during his time with the Beatles, he probably wrote a lot better songs, but that was always a favorite of mine, Don't Bother Me. So again, also on With the Beatles, so check it out if you haven't. Oh my gosh, I love. So Paul's grandfather, meanwhile, took Ringo's. Ringo had an invitation to like a gambling club or something like that, and Paul's grandfather essentially stole it, and he also stole this butler's like tux, and essentially went there and is you know gambling, and he basically like stole posed as a waiter and kind of stole these other guys like chips, and he used it to like gamble again. So again, Wilford Bramble, really funny in this movie. He was pretty dang funny, if you ask me. Of course, one of the things that they say is, one of the things that they mention in this, they always mention is that, you know, Paul's grandfather is like, he's a nice, clean old man, isn't he? And I think that's actually kind of a reference, because Wilford Bramble in an old role that he did before the Beatles was that he one of his characters was considered like a dirty old man or something like that, so they wanted to try and fix that up. It's like, he's a clean old man, isn't he? and then Norm comes and finds them, and they're going to kick him out. And I always love how there's just no sound. You can't hear Norm in this song here. Oh my goodness. Yeah, Norm Rossington plays the part of the really stuffy manager really well, I believe. So I wonder. It's kind of weird. They changed their outfits. I don't know. Wonder what happened there. And there's like the old butler in the. There's an old butler in the cabinet. No, in the closet. Oh my goodness. So basically, like, the old man has just spilled the beans that Paul's grandfather has gone to the gambling club. So yeah, it's also really funny because it seems like they speak a lot of French at this, like, gambling club that they're at. However, like, that Paul's grandfather hasn't, you know, doesn't know a lick of, you know, French and all that kind of stuff, so. Have you had an old man here? I'm his grandma. And then they basically pull him out of the place. Easy come, easy go. Well, man, some classic scenes in this movie. No, so now the next morning, John's in a tub and he's speaking in some very broken German, which the Beatles would have known. I would say they should know a little bit of conversational German. The Beatles, their main break or their main kind of rise to fame actually kind of happened when they were playing kind of overseas in Hamburg, Germany, and so they, and then you know, obviously going all over Europe, you know, during this time, so they've been around Europe quite a bit, so you know they know some of their, you know, European languages. It's always like really kind of just, it's kind of just like a, I don't know, like say fly on the wall kind of, you know, it's not really like, because there's not really a story going on here. It's just kind of like a day in the life of these, like a fictional day in the life of these kids and of the Beatles and that kind of thing, so. And he's, so basically like shows like these really like just, you know, nonchalant, just like these kind of pointless scenes of like Ringo, of like George, like putting like shaving cream on like a window on like a mirror and like shaving like Shake's like fake beard and essentially Jean in a disappearing into a bathtub, which I've always wondered how he did that or what the actual like explanation is. I love how John then comes and is like, there's a car waiting, come on. And then apparently the Beatles are going to a television show or something they have to do. Which again, I mean, this is something that they would do a lot. I mean, the Beatles in the early days, while they in their early 60s, while the Beatles were in their so-called touring years, they actually according to them, their record deals during the early days really weren't that good. They didn't make a whole lot of money off of selling records or off of, you know, the albums that they made. They actually made the most of their money in their live performances and their TV shows. So, of course, Ringo Starr in the early days basically said, like, yeah, we had one of the crappiest record deals of all time. So yeah. I also love just, like, the comedy I feel like it's like this movie, like it's funny without like the super jokes. I mean, I feel like it's funny. So they got like the scene right here. There's like this hors d'oeuvres tray passing around, and all four of the guys are trying to like pick something off of the plate there, and the plate kind of goes a little bit too fast, and they're not even, none of them are able to pick anything off. So. And this scene is also really funny because it's just literally just like them four in a room filled with like reporters and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and they're essentially just asking them all these questions and, you know, legendary responses. In fact, this scene right here, it's woman asks Ringo, "Are you a mod or a rocker?" And then actually, apparently, there was groups in the British called mods, and they're called mods or rockers, and you know, of course, Ringo obviously going straight down the middle is like, I'm a mocker. So, in fact, I think that's actually like one of the most famous, probably one of the more famous, film lines, from this movie. Actually, also the Beatles' haircut name, Arthur, he's like, what do you call that hairstyle, Arthur? George Harrison being pretty cheeky on all that kind of stuff. Of course, it's actually George Harrison is actually, George Harrison probably one of the funnier members of the Beatles. I mean, I feel like from what I've heard about George Harrison, his sense of humor is, I think, more akin to mine, just personally speaking. In fact, actually, one of the first time that they ever met George Martin, who went on to produce essentially almost all their records, I'd say, except Let It Be, and then maybe a few others after that, but George Martin was, collaborated with them. George Martin collaborated with them and really was the one that gave them their first record deal and really got the ball rolling on their kind of rise to stardom. I mean, two guys that were really important in that, George Martin, their record producer that signed them on, I think, to EMI Records, I think it was. Or maybe it was Parlophone. I'm not really sure. It's all kinds of complicated stuff. Somebody else knows better than I do. But George Martin signed them on to the record deal that enabled them to start making, singles, make a record. And then, Brian Epstein, who really was the driving force behind, Brian Epstein was running a record store, one of the largest, his family was running one of the largest record stores in Liverpool, I believe, and he discovered them at the Cavern Club one day, and he was like, I want to be a part of this, band, and, Brian Epstein was really the one that, he kind of shaped their image. I mean, he really got them to start wearing, a lot of those famous scenes and of those famous shots of the Beatles in, those old, when they're playing. I mean, they're wearing, suits and nice-looking suits and ties and, these boots. And originally they were, wearing, leather jackets and leather apparel. But, Brian Epstein wanted to kind of have a bit more of a better portrayal, per se. And then, of course, he was also the one that really got them, got them to George Martin and was trying to get them signed to all these record deals. So yeah. But anyway, going back to George Harrison, they first played for George Harrison, I believe, for George Martin, actually, not George Harrison. So George Martin and George Harrison, this is going to get really confusing, but George Martin... So basically, the Beatles, the four guys, they kind of had played like a bit of an audition for George Martin to kind of see do you think they can make it and whatnot. And to be quite honest with you, George Martin wasn't too impressed with them at first. He wasn't really seeing it at first when he first met them. But one of the things that I think really broke the tension with them is I think George Martin came up to them and was like, "Well, is there anything that you don't like?" And then George Harrison, it was kind of a bit of a nervous bit in the conversation, but George Harrison went up to George Martin and was like, "Yes, I don't like a tie." And apparently, I think the other Beatles were so terrified when he said that, and then, you know, it kind of broke the ice with them. And, you know, then shortly after that, they signed on to the record deal, and, you know, the rest is today's history. So anyway, I've also I've been talking through their rendition of If I Fell in Love with You, which, another great song in the album. I would say A Hard Day's Night, the album, which, you know, the UK album really is not the soundtrack edition in the United States. Of course, anytime that I talk about the Beatles albums, I go to the UK releases. I don't worry about the United States records. But, you know, the A Hard Day's Night, the UK record, to me, is one of their better records, I think, honestly. I mean, it's up there for me. Of course, my favorite record for the Beatles is actually is Rubber Soul, and I don't really know if I have a second favorite after this, but A Hard Day's Night is definitely up there for me. And of course, it's also really monumental, because it's actually the first Beatles album with all Lennon McCartney compositions. You know, of course, you know, Lennon McCartney, the very famous, you know, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, you know, songwriting duo. And, you know, before, especially in the first two albums that they had made, Please Please Me and With the Beatles, I mean, they had a few, you know, snippets of Lennon McCartney songs. I mean, Love Me Do, Please Please Me, I Saw Her Standing There. I mean, all those, you know, very famous Lennon McCartney compositions. But, you know, also, you know, Twist and Shout, any other, like, there's other Boys that sung by Ringo in that first album. I mean, you know, they did a lot of covers in those first couple of albums. And and of course, you know, Hard Day's Night, you know, kind of a good step in the direction of them writing their own songs, because that was actually one of the things back in the days that was apparently was kind of revolutionary. Of course, now that we think about it, I mean, this is, you know, commonplace nowadays, but, you know, the Beatles were apparently one of the very one of the first bands ever to, you know, they're the guys that, you know, wrote their own songs, because apparently you would have, like, you know, bands that would, when you would have bands record songs, they would go to, like, the studios, and then, like, the producers would, like, pick songs out for them to play, and then they would play those songs and all that kind of stuff. And the Beatles were one of the few, or the Beatles were one of the, you know, they were one of the first ones to be like, hey, we have our own songs and we want to record these songs ourselves. So there's that. So I'd say probably the other famous song from this album, Can't Buy Me Love. We got the famous Can't Buy Me Love, the first famous Can't Buy Me Love kind of, you know, like, kind of montage in this film here. And it basically just kind of shows them, I think these are all helicopter shots, and they're basically just showing the Beatles just in a giant field, just kind of running around, just making fools of themselves, which is kind of funny, so. It was actually funny. John Lennon is actually not present in any of these scenes, in these, especially these long scenes here, because he wasn't available. He was he was actually promoting his book, which I believe it was John Lennon in his own right. It was like a song. It was like a compilation of, like, his own, like, poetry that he had written, and a lot of it was kind of like funny poetry and all that kind of stuff. But he went around, so they had a body double that was there for that, and you actually kind of see some of the close-up shots here. You only see you know, Ringo, George, and you know, Paul here. Of course, this looks like John here. I'm not really sure if that was actually John, but that looks like John there. So of course the hair also kind of looks good. So of course the camera's also really shaky, because you really can't tell who's who here. So and they have their famous, like, you know, jumping in the air, like, you know, like, scenes there, so. Yeah. And yeah, another just also kind of another like famous scene of the Beatles, kind of an also just another famous scene of them, because they were another famous scene kind of in like the in the inspiration of like the music video, because it's definitely got that like music video vibe when you watch that kind of montage of them just running around in the field and Can't Buy Me Love just kind of, you know, playing in the background. It definitely seems like this is a music video type that they were making or something like that. I don't know. So definitely in the modern sense of the word, you know, if they made a music video for Hard Day's for Can't Buy Me Love and they did that, I thought it'd be pretty awesome. So it's actually really funny because there was a scene just now with it was Norman Rosington, John Junkin, however you say his name, I'm not sure. We also just saw Mal Evans just walk by. I just noticed that. This John is looking with this woman, and I don't really understand this scene right here, because this woman thinks that John looks like somebody, and like then at the end of the scene she's like, you know, you don't look like him at all. And then, you know, John gets kind of upset. He's like, you know, she looks more like him than I do, you know, that kind of thing. So, because I never understood this scene. Of course, I also just talked over this scene, so I didn't really, I didn't, you know, catch the dialogue in between them. Of course, I haven't seen this movie in like 2 years, maybe 2.5, maybe a year and a half, something like that. I haven't really sat down and watched it all the way through in a long time, so. Of course, you got George Harrison going to this office or something like that. Apparently, he's got another scene that I'm not really sure the meaning behind this. Of course, because George Harrison's going to like this, like he accidentally stumbled into like this fashion designer's like this like fashion designer's like office, and apparently like the fashion designer's gonna ask him about all these like, you know, clothes that they'd wear and all this kind of stuff, and George is like, we wouldn't be called dead wearing any of these. And so it's again, I think it's just another like just kind of funny scene for them to be, funny scene for George or something like that. Of course, I always love this scene because, like, this, I don't know who plays this, like, fashion designer. He's definitely kind of like a European-ish style fashion designer, but he shows, like, George Harrison, like, all these, like, clothes that he's, like, designing, and George just, like, kind of poo-poos them and all this kind of stuff, and he really, like, and he kind of, and he in the fashion designer is like really just like taken aback by like his criticisms, like, get him out of here, get him out of here. Although I do admit, I mean, those shirts look kind of nice. I don't know why George Harrison doesn't. I don't know why he doesn't like them. So I wouldn't be. I wouldn't be said dead in that. Of course, this guy doesn't know that, you know, he's, you know, talking to one of the Beatles, and whatever the Beatles basically wore in the 60s, you know, was what everybody wanted to wear, so. Of course, I mean, that was one of the things I'm pretty sure, like, back in the days, I mean, people were going to all kinds of barbershops trying to get, you know, Beatles haircuts, or they were trying to, like, you know, they were even, like, you know, advertising, like, places where, like, you could buy, like, the Beatles-style boots that you could wear and that kind of thing, so. So. And then also George Harrison's now like talking about some like teenager that the marketing that the like fashion designers talking about. She's a jack. Get him out of it. And I love how George Harrison's just so nonchalant about it. He just like just ruins this guy's day. I will admit, I mean, this movie is like one of the funniest movies, and it doesn't really even try to be. That's I think that's one of the keys of being, I think, a great comedy. You get a movie that is funny based on the characters, not based on any gags, not based on any jokes. You know, a movie that's funny based on just the characters. And, you know, they tell some jokes, and, you know, they have some funny lines, and there's some slapstick that happens. But, I mean, shoot, I mean, it's basically funny because, I mean, shoot, these four guys are, you know, just that funny. I mean, I think even in real life, you get the sense that they're just, you know, they're this funny, so. And again, I'll talk about it later, but one of my reasons that I think that the Beatles have, you know, kind of stuck around in our pop culture. I mean, shoot, even nowadays they're one of the most listened to, you know, bands in, you know, the history of the world. And I think one of the reasons that is, you know, they touch so many demographics. I mean, you know, if you're a music fan, I mean, their music production is already legendary enough as it is. But then they're also, you know, if they wanted to be, they could be, you know, comedians as well. And, you know, you see here in this film here, I mean, they make, you know, they also make, you know, kick-ass actors as well. So, I mean, it's, and then, you know, also, you know, John Lennon, you know, did a little bit of writing and, I don't know, it was like, they just were so, like, versatile and, like, their talents and all that kind of stuff, so. And, you know, just like in the terms of pop culture, they were just so, they just touched so many demographics that, you know, they were able to become popular or something like that. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I think you understand what I'm saying. Like they're a great act. They're great singers and songwriters. They're really funny, charismatic guys that were also pretty good in front of a camera as well. And then, you know, they could also, you know, write books, and, you know, they could do all kinds of things. And, you know, obviously, versatility nowadays, you know, people that are good at a lot of things, you know, become really popular, you know. I can see, you know, people that are film fans that don't really give a lick about music that could become fans of them, or, you know, fans of comedy that can become fans of them literally by the alone of their interviews and alone of just watching this movie here without even listening to any of their music. You know, I can imagine how, you know, people would become fans of that. And that's like one of the reasons I've really kind of grown attached to them. You know, their sense of humor, I'm not gonna lie, really matches my sense of humor, honestly. So it's kind of like that dry, cheeky sense of humor, really, that they like, that they're all that kind of stuff. So, all right, so now we're playing And I Love Her, which I do admit, this is it's in a different key than the album version. It's a bit of a different, I don't know, it's like a different octave or key or something like that. Of course, I'm pretty sure also if I was listening like with my uncle was really the one that really got me into the Beatles. I'm pretty sure he would be able to tell me, he's like, oh, it's in this key in the album, and then this key in the film, so. And again, this scene right here, it's another example of the kind of the genesis idea of the music video, because a lot of these, like, they're doing a lot of, like, kind of, like, fade cuts and wipe cuts and all this kind of stuff to the, you know, and it really just, it evokes the sense of just, you know, of, you know, the modern day music video. I mean, you look at the cuts and, like, the way that they're filming this scene of them playing And I Love Her, and you see, like, yeah, this looks like a, you know, looks like a music video and that kind of thing. So it's like, but you know, back in the day, I mean, in a film, in a feature length film, I mean, this, you know, this wasn't common. In fact, this was one of the first films that ever did this, so I mean, it's just, I mean, you know, legendary maybe be a big word, but I mean, it was, you know, definitely inspiring for, you know, leaving a lasting legacy for, you know, the rest of, you know, for all time or something like that. I don't know. What's actually interesting is, and I think I read this actually, and right before I watched this, but apparently Ringo is playing. So Ringo plays the bongos in this song. He doesn't play like the actual drums, and apparently he's playing the bongos the wrong way. Of course, also the famous lore of Ringo is that he's a left-handed drummer playing on a right-handed kit, and you can always see that he's kind of, I wouldn't say a little awkward playing on the right-handed kit, like, 'cause of course the right-handed kit's kind of the standard kit nowadays for basically anybody playing, but apparently when he's playing the bongos, he's playing it kind of like kind of flipped, and apparently, like, I don't know, it's a little weird, so I don't know how to play the bongo, so I couldn't tell you. Of course, as a prospective drummer myself, I've also stated how I've always really appreciated and always thought how awesome it was for Ringo to be a left-handed drummer, basically playing on a right-handed kit, because he's, 'cause you gotta imagine, I mean, it's basically all backwards for you. I mean, of course, I mean, Ringo was also taught to be right-handed at an early age because his mu I think it was his grandmother was one of those, like, left-handedness is the sign of the devil kind of people. So but of course also, like, by just, like, so he could play right-handed and he learned how to be right-handed, but, like, when it came to, like, just, like, natural, like, feel of a drum, you know, he couldn't really do it because, like, he always had to lead with his left hand because he was just biologically inclined to be left-handed. So he could basically keep a he could keep a beat on a le on the right-handed kit, but when he did, like, a fill, I mean, it was always kind of wonky because he would lead with his left hand. And when you lead with your left hand on a right-handed drum kit, I can tell you it's really awkward because I've always tried to lead with my I've always tried to lead with my left hand on the right-handed kit while trying to do a fill, and it's really awkward, one, when you're trying to do the fill when you're not left-handed, but it's also really awkward because you kind of have to go, like, you have to bring, like, the hand under it, and, you know, Ringo talks about this all the time, but it also really adds to the it adds to, like, you know, his, you know, sound, all that kind of stuff. So I think that's one of the things about the Beatles, honestly, is that I think that's one of the things about the Beatles, really, is that it's a great example of how the sum is greater than the, no, how the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, actually. Because if you take the Beatles by themselves, I mean, you get, you know, John Lennon's a really good, you know, guitarist, rhythm guitarist. You know, Paul McCartney's, you know, one of the most versatile musicians of all time. I mean, one of the greatest singers, songwriters of our, you know, of our time. You know, great. You know, he plays the piano, plays the drums, plays the bass, plays the guitar. I mean, he's basically a one-man band on his own. George Harrison, you know, legendary, you know, guitar player, you know, legendary songwriter in his own right. Then Ringo Starr, you know, Ringo Starr, you know, a lot of people would say, you know, not the greatest drummer, not the greatest drummer in the world, but, you know, he, you know, keeps a great beat and is really, you know, reliable drummer. So, and but when you get them together, you know, there's just something there that just, you know, there's just something there that, you know, you just can't replicate easily. I mean, again, I think it's also their chemistry and, you know, the brotherhood of, you know, that they had together, and, you know, the fact that they really liked playing music with each other. So I mean, it's really a perfect storm of, you know, it's like a cosmic perfect storm in my eyes, honestly, but I don't know. Mean, I think if you really, I mean, also, like, one of the things, like, about the whole, like, you know, the sum is greater than the whole is greater than the sum of its parts of the Beatles is that I feel like if you put the Beatles, say if you compared the Beatles with a band like, Led Zeppelin, I would say, I mean, if you compared like each of the components of Led Zeppelin to the Beatles, I would say a lot of people like, yeah, Jimmy Page is probably like is a bit more of a technical better guitarist than, you know, George Harrison. Of course, other people would, you know, completely disagree with me on this, or, you know, John Bonham is technically a much better drummer than, you know, Ringo Starr, and, you know, Robert Plant, you know, can sing, you know, much higher and, more range than Paul McCartney can, and, you know, John Paul Jones also, you know, can, you know, really groovy, you know, bass, you know, lyrics. But, and, you know, again, Led Zeppelin, they were, you know, again, legendary band on their own right, and, you know, they were, you know, another band that's, you know, amazing, but just didn't really resonate with everybody like the Beatles can. Because I feel like for the Beatles, there's something with every song, with like everything that they did, there's like something for a little something for everybody. So I don't know. And they also just played I'm happy just to dance with you. Lennon McCartney composition sung by George Harrison, which I think that song, and then George sings another song on A Hard Day's Night. Yeah, George sings another song on A Hard Day's Night. I wonder which one he does, because I know that he does. I'm happy just to dance with you. So that's the only one that he sings. Shoot, this is very much a heavy McCartney Lennon, Lennon McCartney album. So, now we have the scene here, and then another bit of comedy here. I don't know why this guy, he just took like a bottle of ketchup and like put it on his sling. We're in this like restaurant right now, and Ringo's reading a book, and he's kind of watching after Paul's grandfather. And he's kind of telling Ringo, like, you know, you gotta stand up for yourself, because, you know, you're the drummer, and you're getting treated like a bit of sham or whatever British thing that he's saying. And Ringo's trying to, like, go out and do his own thing or something like that. No, he says he's like going like do his own parade or something like that. I don't know. Again, you know, it kind of goes into that fact that Ringo's, I think they're, again, it's just trying, he's trying to play into the fact that Ringo's a bit of an underrated member of the group. Which I think history puts Ringo, I think ultimately history finally kind of accepts the Beatles as a whole instead of like just, you know, the individuals, because I will admit, you know, the Beatles, you know, without one, if there was one of the four members that weren't in the Beatles, then the Beatles just aren't the Beatles. Let's just be quite honest with that. If Ringo wasn't the drummer, they weren't the Beatles. If John Lennon wasn't, you know, part of that, if John Lennon wasn't a part of that songwriting duo, there wasn't going to be any Beatles. If George Harrison wasn't the lead guitarist, there aren't any Beatles. And I mean, again, they were a cosmic, some kind of, I get kind of like big, very philosophical, and I know like my astrology friends would get a little bit excited about this, even though I know nothing about that. But lightning in a bottle, you know, once in like a 100 generational, like aptitude for musical talent, for music. I don't know what it's. It's something that just never happens, you know. It happens once, and then it almost never happens again. Something of how good these guys were, and like the storm that they created, and the lasting impact that they had on pop culture. So, so now Ringo is leaving the. Ringo is now leaving the Ringo's walking out on them, and he's essentially, I think what he said, he's going to go parade around and do his own thing, and he's basically taking, like, a camera, and he's going out to, like, just take pictures and all that kind of stuff, so. Which I don't know how they, so the other three are going out to look for him, but I don't know how they can find him, because he literally just walked out the door. He just walked out the door, and they don't see him. That's kind of stupid. Now, this is actually really interesting. This is a... So, this is an instrumental version of... This Boy, you know, again, another song by the Beatles, that they, another song that they are famous for, like, This Boy, and, they always kind of call it, like, you know, Ringo's theme, because, I mean, it's really famous, you know, for this scene right here. Of course, this is a very famous scene for, this is a really famous scene for Ringo, because, he was actually quite lauded for his acting in this scene. Of course, you know, Ringo is always kind of known for being the more theatrical one, and the one that was he was actually the one after the Beatles even broke up. He was very much the one that wanted to become an actor and, you know, wanted to act in his own films and do that. So. Of course, the interesting thing about this scene, that when he was shooting this scene, is that he was actually hungover. So a lot of this was done, I think he was either hungover or even partially drunk. So there was some, and, you know, of course, a lot of this, like, you know, him moving around is just him recovering from being hungover and drunk. So yeah. I believe this is, like, towards the end of production when they were filming these scenes here. Look. And then he trips on a tire. I'm pretty sure that he was actually drunk, because he just literally just, like, tripped over a tire. Or unless he actually did that purposefully. You know, actually, it was really... No, it's actually kind of interesting, like, Ringo holding that camera, because, I mean, the Beatles, when they were, you know, in the middle of their, you know, Beatlemania, you know, they were actually, you know, basically, there was a hurricane of Beatlemania, and they were really in the eye of it. They actually took a lot of pictures, you know, of themselves. They took a lot of pictures of kind of their surroundings, of what was going on. And, you know, Ringo actually has this, like, really famous picture of, like, where he, where, like, a car of, like, teenager fans kind of rolled up beside them, and he took a picture of them. And apparently, the people reunited, like, 50 years after that, and, like, took a picture, like, basically recreated that picture, which was, you know, again, really, really interesting. But, no, I mean, they took a lot of pictures, while they were on the road, and while they were, and while they were, you know, yeah, obviously, you know, going through all the Beatlemania, you know, stuff, so. And now, like, the world is coming to an end, because, you know, Ringo is now missing, because they're not at the studio for the final run through. So it's like, oh no. When Ringo is, like, eating, like, some kind of sandwich there. So So now Ringo is apparently paying for a sandwich and a beer. Oh, and his beer just crashed. Yeah, he's just like, again, here's that more of like that slapstick coming in because, you know, Ringo's, it's more of the Ringo because, you know, he's obviously kind of more of the, he's always been kind of more of the clown of the group because, you know, this, of his like slapstick kind of deal, that kind of thing. So, oh dear, he almost just hit that bird. And you always see that there's like a policeman like following Ringo. Like he's like, how are they getting like all that? I feel like that. I feel like I've seen that policeman in a movie before. I'm not sure though. You know, it's actually really interesting because you know you see, I've mentioned in other shows before and in. That, and I haven't mentioned it before in this film, but I just now notice it with Norm Rossington smoking, that when this film was released in America, there was actually a bit of an uproar over there was actually kind of an uproar in America for seeing these guys basically smoking. Apparently even Elvis was, you know, Elvis Presley was actually kind of, you know, taken aback by seeing these guys, you know, basically smoking and on screen and whatnot. Of course, I feel like, you know, smoking back in the 60s on screen, maybe not in America, but I feel like, I mean, it would have been a little bit more, you know, common in films. Of course, you know, nowadays, I feel like you never would see, you know, people smoking real cigarettes. I mean, I'm pretty sure if they were actually smoking in, they were actually shown to be smoking in a film, I'm pretty sure they'd be using, like, you know, fake cigarettes or that kind of thing. So, I wouldn't say controversy when they showed the smoking in the film, but it was something that I don't think American fans were really ready for or something like that. And another interesting thing about this movie is that the Beatles, oh, and here's Ringo doing his, oh my goodness, so he found like this like pretty one, he found this woman that he's like doing the whole like stupid like put the coat down and have the woman walk over it kind of shtick, and then like he puts one thing down and then this woman actually like falls into the hole. And then Ringo gets apprehended by the police for some reason. I don't know why, but, and again, I feel like I've seen that police, the policeman that just apprehended him somewhere before, but I don't know where, but that's just me, so. And then same with this police sergeant, of course, I feel like they all look the same to me in movies, so. And then what was I going to say? Oh yeah, so another interesting, before I got interrupted by that really funny scene there, but so when they finally made this movie, one of the things that that United Artists was wanting the filmmakers to do was they actually wanted the film to be dubbed in more American eyes, like English voices, because people were kind of worried that they wouldn't be able to understand the Liverpudlian accent of, you know, of the Beatles and that kind of stuff. And then John Lennon, Paul McCartney actually apparently got pretty upset when he heard that was actually going to be happening. I think one of the quote was, if we have to listen to a, and I'm going to paraphrase here, kind of clean up the language, if we have to listen to a dang Texan, you know, freaking American, then they can listen to our effing Liverpool accents and blah, blah, blah. So apparently they got pretty upset about that. It's also kind of one of the things that I noticed with when they make the, like, Swamp Hunters you know, shows of like people that live down in like Louisiana, and they kind of hunt those crocodiles, and you have to like put like subtitles to understand like the Cajun. Of course, people that live down there, and I have a lot of family that lives down in the South, they had a lot of you know, they understand it even without the subtitles, so it's kind of funny. They could have added the subtitles in this film, but obviously they didn't, so. And then apparently Paul's grandfather is like saying that the police is out to get him, and they're like some kind of assassins or something like that. I also think this is one of the first like instances of like people like drawing like mustaches and glasses like on a TV screen, because George Harrison just did that on that screen there. So, of course, also Wilford Bramble and, you know, Paul McCartney's, you know, supposed grandfather is also really apparently he runs like an old man, so. Gotta love this. He's like paying these kids to distract a police officer. And he's trying to like go get. Kind of funny. It's like a little bit of a Blues Brother like chase. Like the police are chasing after them. Now they're going to start the final, quote-unquote, chase in the film. They're going to go to the police. The three guys go to the police station and bust Ringo out. And yet another rendition of Can't Buy Me Love appears on the screens, appears in the background, so. You also love it because, like, it's kind of funny because, like, the three Beatles go into the police station. Basically, apparently they distract the police officers, and then they start running out, and the police officers go chasing after them. And then Ringo, after that, kind of saunters out and starts chasing by them. So it's really interesting. Like half this movie is basically like the four lads getting like chased by various people. So. And it's really funny because, like, while they're chasing him, like, back and forth, like, the police are, like, running by this guy that is trying to, like, carjack, like, this parked car or something like that, so. So, yeah, it's always kind of funny like that. I feel like this scene also, like, in a part way, kind of inspires the Blues Brothers, because it's basically, like, a huge giant police chase, and then like it just keeps like growing and growing and growing and growing and growing and all that kind of stuff. So, and I also love how like John like kind of sneaks behind the police officers in that scene there. So again, just kind of adds to like the slapstick nature of the chase and all that kind of stuff. And then that carjacker like breaks into that car, and then one of the police officers like tells him, "Hey, go chase after those guys." Although I will admit, I don't think that they would be allowed to be playing if the police were actively after them, but of course it also was a film, so. Now, this TV director, I think he's played by Victor Spinetti, or he's played by some British actor, but I don't really know, but he definitely gives a pretty solid performance here, so. Oh, great acting scene by John Lennon here. He's basically like kind of talking to his, like, yeah, you should have gone west to America. Instead, you took a, instead you stayed in, instead you took a wrong turn. Now, look, you're a lonely old man from Liverpool. And I love that. I love it's a really well acted scene by John Lennon again. That, you know, for as inexperienced as these guys are in acting, they're actually really good actors. In fact, it's actually kind of an interesting story because they had to. Because there's a there was an actors union in the United Kingdom that apparently you had to be a part of in order to, act in a film, and apparently they had to literally be initiated like on the first day of shooting, and they apparently had to be helped by like Wilford Bramble and, you know, Norman Rossington. So now we have the famous final, you know, TV kind of apparently the supposed TV appearance of, you know, them playing their songs. Now, this final, like, concert is actually really, it's really, again, really famous for, you know, how it's, like, you know, how it's edited together, looking like, you know, a music video, and it kind of, you know, inspires, like, you know, the, our modern interpretation of music videos is what I've been talking about all through the film. But, also one thing that, you know, Dick Lester and the filmmakers did while they were making this was that they use multiple cameras to shoot this. I mean, there's lots of cameras, you know, at work here. And I think it was like either five or six cameras that were, you know, capturing this. And one of the funnier stories actually, while with one of the cameramen that was actually like in the crowd with like all the screaming, like, you know, young people and whatnot, is that they were I think they took about like 3 or so days to like film this, but apparently some of them, like, there were filmmakers that were in the crowd with like the late with like all the young girls like screaming their heads off and that kind of thing, and after about a couple days of shooting that, the cameramen were like complaining of like aches in their mouth because like all of the vibration and all of like the screaming had like caused like some people's like teeth to start cracking. And I kid you not on that. I mean, that's how like loud some of these like loud and like vibracious some of these like, you know, young kids were like, you know, yelling at the Beatles. So of course, I don't think they were actually like playing this. I think it was, again, they were miming it. They may have done like some kind of like, you know, mock concert, but I feel like, again, those are real fans like in the audience there, and, you know, I'm pretty sure that's also like, you know, real, you know, fans like screaming. So actually, really interesting. There was a cut scene from there was a cut musical number. I think it was. It was either I'll Cry Instead or Anytime at All, I think. One of those two was supposed to be in this film, and it was actually going to be really interesting because Phil Collins, the drummer for the band Genesis, and then also famous for his, like, In the Air Tonight song, apparently he was supposed to be, you know, shown in the audience as, you know, just one of the audience members, so. And, of course, you know, Phil Collins is, you know, I think he has cited, you know, Ringo as, you know, an inspiration to his drumming, so. That kind of thing. You can definitely notice the effect of the shaky cam. The effect of the shaky cam in this film, because there's so much, like, handheld, like, shaky, like, you know, film that's been used in this film, so. And this is also, you know, this is about like, you know, about 10 or so years before Garrett Brown invented the Steadicam. So, I mean, you know, nobody, you know, they wouldn't have, you know, been able to have those like smoother, like, you know, shots that, you know, the Steadicam would have been able to make. of course, also the shaky cam kind of also adds to the it adds to the you know, the documentary-ish style of the film here. So, and then like even like this like shot right here, like, I mean, at the end here, I mean, it's shot just like, you know, the Beatles music videos that they made in the 60s. I mean, it's so similar to the stuff that they made back then, so. All right, so, yeah. And they're playing I Should Have Known Better again. Again, a down, probably down an octave or half octave or something like that. I never understood why they did this in the film, like why they kind of why they played it down an octave in the different than the studio album version. I don't know. So they also show that Ringo's got his famous Black Oyster Pearl Ludwig drums, probably the most like famous drum set in, you know, in the history of. In the history of rock and roll, to be quite honest with you. You also got George Harrison's 12-string, I think it's like his 12-string Rickenbacker, I think it was. And, which of course, you know, George uses ostensibly as, you know, as the lead guitarist, so. You know, even towards the kind of the end here, I mean, they even said, like, I mean, George Harrison playing guitar for the Beatles was, you know, he even when he started with the Beatles, because he was one of the youngest members of, he was very young when he met the Beatles. I mean, John Lennon, when he first met George Harrison, thought he was too young to be in the band. And, you know, right away, you know, John Lennon, you know, Paul McCartney, you know, realized, you know, how, you know, talented George Harrison was and, you know, how talented they were and, you know, how he could be the, how George Harrison would be, you know, a great, you know, lead guitarist for them. In fact, apparently the way that George Harrison was able to get onto playing for them is that they actually ended up on the top deck of a double-decker bus, and there was a song called Raunchy that apparently George Harrison could just play like immaculately, and like Paul essentially said to George, like, hey, get your guitar, George, get your guitar out and play Raunchy. So he got it out and he played it, and apparently John Lennon was just so impressed by it that he, you know, invited him into the band, and, you know, the rest was history, and that's how that happened. And then obviously, you know, no Beatles performance in the early 60s would be incomplete without playing She Loves You, which is, you know, I'd say, you know, that along, I'd say She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand, I'd say probably the two songs that most epitomize the Beatlemania of the early to mid 60s, because they would play those songs at almost every single, you know, like, show that they played at. So it was I'm pretty sure for them it'd be getting annoying. I mean, I know that one of the things that they said, you know, as they kind of went along, you know, as they went along in the 60s, I mean, they as they grew, because you got to imagine, I mean, these guys started this band a lot of them when they were like really, really early 20s, and even for George Harrison, he started when he was like in his late teens. So, I mean, these guys were, you know, honestly basically kids when they were starting this band out. And then obviously as the 60s went along, you know, you grow up, as they grew up, they, you know, they matured, you know, as obviously the 60s was also the, you know, the counterculture era and that kind of thing. So, and, you know, as they grew up, I mean, their music tastes, they matured with them, and, you know, they went away from being, you know, these, you know, four, you know, young mop tops that wanted to play She Loves You all the time, and to, like, you know, playing more like grown-up songs, like in, you know, Rubber Soul and Revolver, to, like, doing like really experimental stuff, like in, you know, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band to, you know, the White Album to even, you know, White Abbey Road to their final stuff. So, again, the Beatles, I mean, always maturing, always changing in the 60s. I mean, that's the one thing that's always one of the things that's great about them is that, you know, they weren't a one-trick pony. I mean, they could do all kinds of different things. And that's maybe what I was trying to say earlier with how, you know, they're so versatile and kind of how they were, you know, and they could do all kinds of different things. And again, they weren't a one-trick pony. I mean, some of their earlier albums were very much like were very much them playing like pop rock songs for the fans and all that kind of stuff. So, but then as they went along, I mean, you know, they went into more like, you know, serious, they went to like more serious stuff, like, you know, Rubber Soul is a lot of like very deep introspective, you know, kind of, you know, music for them to play. And then, you know, Revolver, you started getting to like a more like experimental music, like, you know, Tomorrow Never Knows and what's another one there? And yeah, Tomorrow Never Knows is probably the best part of that. But again, more serious stuff, not just like She Loves You, I Want to Hold Your Hand, you know, pop rock songs kind of thing. So, so we're going through the credits here, and again, this is a great credit scene here because it's, you know, it's pictures from the photo shoot of the you know, that they use for the album, because, you know, the album is actually like just a whole bunch of, the album cover is a whole bunch of, you know, pictures, you know, about four pictures of John, four pictures of Ringo, four pictures of George, and four pictures of of Paul. No, that's what I was trying to say. And I always really loved just kind of these, you know, shots here and how they kind of just kind of end the film. And it's just a really nice, just nice bookend to the film. So, and then you also kind of end with, you know, the Hard Day's Night. So, and I also really love how the credits kind of end here, and the arpeggio that they play at the end there, because it ends on right here on, I believe that's John Lennon's, the back of his head, and there's the end kind of that he's kind of facing the camera there. So, and so that's that. So that is the first of the Beatles theatrical films that they released. Now, the Beatles while they were still the Beatles, they were involved in four more films after this. They made, about a year after this film, they made, because they actually, when they started this film, they actually signed a three-picture deal with United Artists, and this is the first picture of that three-picture deal. They made this film, then they made Help the next year later, which I will admit, personally, I'm not the biggest fan of Help as a film. I mean, I think it works fine, but if you're really a fan of this film, I think you're just stick with this film. I mean, if you're a fan of the Beatles, I'd say watch Help, but this film kind of sets the bar pretty high and kind of makes Help at least for me, a bit of a tough watch. And then after Help, I think 2 years after Help in 67, they made a TV film called Magical Mystery Tour, which turned into an album, The Magical Mystery Tour, which to me is, I'd say, one of the most underrated albums that they've ever made. I mean, it's an outlier of Beatles albums, even though, like, even as they were getting into the more experimental, you know, experimental kind of out there kind of music in the later stages of their, you know, era in the 60s. I mean, that one I still even is very weird for their liking, but it also has a lot of really good songs in it as well. And then there also was in 1960, I believe this was made in 68 or 69, one of those 2 years, they released an animated film called Yellow Submarine, based on the, you know, song, you know, song by Ringo Starr, you know, called Yellow Submarine. And it was an animated film. None of the Beatles actually voiced their, you know, animated counterparts. They actually, you know, had voice actors coming in and voicing them, which actually that, apparently was one of the, that was, according to Paul, at least, that was kind of, or I think it was actually, George said this in an interview. He actually said that that was kind of the impetus for the, the Beatles, these really cartoonish accents. Of course, that's how George Harrison talks like that, you know. I try and take his accent from what I see in the film here, and then also talk like, I think you talk like John, you know. He's, you know, talking a bit more snarky and, you know, a bit more grown up, but he's still a bit of a nice guy. And then Paul's like this, you know. He's a bit of more of a cheeky guy, you know, that kind of stuff. And then Ringo, you know, he's a bit of more of a deeper voice and kind of get it in the nose and that kind of thing too. And I just play the drums all day with my big nose. Oh my goodness. So, and then, so yeah, so the Beatles, the only involvement the Beatles had in Yellow Submarine was they filmed a really short, like, kind of cameo at the end of the film after basically the film was over. They filmed, like, a really short cameo with all of them. And then in 1970, in 1969, they made a film, I think it was with David Warner Hogg, and they called it, and it was basically filmed during what was called the Get Back Sessions, which would later become the final album release for the Beatles called Let It Be. And Let It Be basically became like this, like, fly on the wall, like, documentary that basically showcased the Beatles, you know, recording together and, you know, recording the Let It Be album together. However, it was very controversial back in the day, and, you know, it, actually even nowadays, it's the Let It Be, that final Let It Be film, does not have an official home media release. Now, I actually bought like a bootleg copy from eBay, but there's not like an official like Beatles release, like the Beatles like endorsed. There's not like an official like Blu-ray of the film, and it's mainly because like it the film kind of showcases basically the breakup of the Beatles. Like, it basically showcases what's going to lead up to the breakup of the Beatles, and, you know, it shows a lot of arguing and a lot of just like kind of tension in the group while they're recording the songs. So, it's a little, I mean, and that's why, like, even some of the Beatles, like, even Paul and Ringo nowadays are a little hesitant to show it, even though now, I'm pretty sure a lot of you know, Peter Jackson from Lord of the Rings fame and from, you know, the director of the King Kong remake in 2005, he's basically gonna, take a lot of that film that David Warner Hogg filmed, for the Let It Be film, and he's going to basically re-edit it into a new version called, and he's basically going to call it The Beatles Get Back, and it's going to, and according to them, it's actually going to be a bit more of a positive version of the Let It Be film. It's going to be a lot more of the positive interactions between the Beatles, and, you know, hey, you know, it wasn't all, and they're going to try and show us, like, hey, you know, it wasn't all, like, you know, doom and gloom, and, you know, argument while making Let It Be, But yeah, so they wanted to show that they actually had like some good times while filming Let It Be. So, but yeah, no, I mean, this, so that's A Hard Day's Night. And again, it's, you know, it's regarded as a classic, you know, especially for like, you know, for music, like movies and all that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, I can definitely see how like some like modern day music, like a movie like called like, you know, like the famous movie like This Is Spinal Tap. I feel like this film is, I feel like This Is Spinal Tap, which I think is probably the best example of like, you know, like those music kind of, you know, documentary ish comedy style films. You know, I don't think that those would be around without A Hard Day's Night or without the Beatles' work here. So, and again, This Is Spinal Tap is, again, a legendary film. So, I mean, we can have the Beatles to thank for that in A Hard Day's Night. And then, again, you also heard, you know, you also heard me talk about, you know, in the film here, you know, how they basically were the, of, you know, they're basically the inspiration for like MTV and all that kind of stuff. So I'm even reading here I'm even reading here, I have like this little booklet here that I'm reading. Apparently someone even calls this film the Citizen Kane of jukebox movies, which I've never really understood that kind of thinking, but it is kind of like jukebox movies. I've never really understood. I don't know if there's a, is that really a genre of jukebox movies? Again, I'm not really sure, so. But again, I mean, the thing that should be stated, kind of all in all, because I know there's been a lot of just talk about, there's a lot of topics that's been covered here. I mean, from a filmmaking standpoint, you know, talking about the movie here, you know, A Hard Day's Night was really a landmark in the evolution of music in film. You know, the idea of, you know, music videos, you know, and, you know, MTV was, you know, a lot, took a lot of beats from this film right here. I mean, and even like, you know, later, like, you know, kind of like fly on the wall, like, you know, documentaries that bands would make, you know, or kind of like comedies that they would make, you know, took a lot of cues from this film. And even like later comedies, I'm pretty sure took a film, because, I mean, I would say this is one of the funniest movies ever made. And it's really on the basis of, you know, just the Beatles being themselves in this film. So, not only were the Beatles, you know, trendsetters in their, you know, songwriting abilities, they also were, not themselves. I mean, they were, you know, actors, you know, in this film, but I mean, the people that were making this film, they were a part of a film that was, you know, a trendsetter in the media of music and film. So yeah, that's what I got to say on that. And do I have anything else to say on A Hard Day's Night? I don't think I do, actually. Again, just a nice little, like, kind of just weird, flat-out comedy that, you know, there are times in the movie that I obviously knew that I didn't really have a whole lot to talk about, which, you know, it's going to happen, but, you know, again, I always love talking about the Beatles, and, you know, not without a doubt, the greatest band that has ever lived and will probably ever live. So, and I will go to my grave thinking that. So, that's all I'm gonna say on that, y'all. To be quite honest with you, I don't really know what's gonna happen next. What movies I'm gonna be doing next? I have a lot of requests that I've, you know, been kind of holding off for a while that I really need to start working on, and I got my buddy Cody's wanting to, you know, we look on the watch out in the next couple weeks for another podcast with me and Cody. Again, you know, check out our Star Wars podcast that was released about a month and a half ago, and then, you know, we might be recording another episode together, so keep an eye out for that. And again, if you got any, follow me on Facebook and Instagram. I mean, both at the at the Movie Commentary Podcast, just all one word, all undercase letters. Again, if you got any movie requests, send it into Instagram or Facebook, or, you know, my email even my email, themoviecommentarypodcast@yahoo.com. Thank you all for listening to the podcast and watching on YouTube, and that's where I'm going to leave it off at. Thank you all for listening. Stay golden out there, and I will see you on the flip side.